This episode is brought to you by Rose, the spreadsheet where data comes to life. Connected with your business data and delightful to share, Rose is how teams work with numbers and share their results. Head to rose.com/ventureeurope and find out how you can easily manage your cap table, plan your next fundraising round, or import data from your favorite tools. I already moved my spreadsheet to Rose, and you can too. See for yourself how you can make your data come to life for free and visit rose.com/ventureeurope, that is ROWS.com/ventureeurope. I have already prepared some templates like cohort analysis, fundraising tracker, and cap table management, which I'm sure you'll find useful. This episode is also brought to you by Athletic Greens. If you're like me and travel a lot and do not always have access to cook the nutrition meals needed for high performance, then I highly recommend Athletic Greens, my all-in-one nutritional insurance. AG further covers my bases with vitamins, minerals, and whole food-sourced micronutrients that support gut health and the immune system. Right now, Athletic Greens is offering you their vitamin D liquid formula free with your first subscription purchase, a vital nutrient for a strong immune system and strong bones. Visit athleticgreens.com/ventureeurope to claim the special offer today and receive the free vitamin D liquid formula and 5 free travel packs with your first subscription purchase. That's up to 1 year supply of vitamin D as added value when you try their delicious and comprehensive all-in-one daily greens product. I started using Athletic Greens 6 months ago, and my God, it is a game changer. Top health experts and performers like Tim Ferriss, Andrew Huberman, and Lewis Hamilton recommend Athletic Greens. It also tastes great. Visit athleticgreens.com/ventureeurope to taste for yourself. What's up, lovely people? Welcome to a new episode of Venture Europe with me, Colleen Fabry. Today we have a super duper guest. His name is Stef van Grieken, co-founder and CEO of the biotech company Cradle. Based between Delft and Zurich, Cradle's machine learning platform helps scientists to design and program cell factories faster and more successfully, speeding up the development of a more environmentally friendly method of producing almost anything. Anything? Anything. They have recently raised a $6 million seed round co-led by Index Ventures and Kindred Capital. Prior to Cradle, Stef spent 7 years with Google as senior product manager for Google AI, known as Google Brain, and Google X, known for its moonshots projects. During this episode, we discuss about the founding story of Cradle, how you can program cells to produce milk, plastic, and petrol-free chemicals, among other things, and why Europeans should change from being definite pessimists to definite optimists and be more entrepreneurial and take more risks. Let's do it, guys. Stef is one of those rare breeds of entrepreneurs with a high amount of raw intelligence and kindness. If you don't believe me, listen to Lila from Kindred and Sophia from Index on what they had to say about Stef, the team, and Cradle. Enjoy.
Stef really struck us as one of those incredibly unique founders who has both the courage to undertake something incredibly audacious, but also the genius to make it happen. We love founders who have so much raw curiosity and raw capacity that whereas they may have grown up in one discipline, so in Stef's case, sort of the world of bits, but you know, have become so fascinated with another world, in this case, the world of atoms, and that you know, they really steep themselves, immerse themselves in it, and they bring that really rare multidisciplinary knowledge that combines multiple disciplines into one pretty extraordinary brain. We at Kindred think that that's where some of the biggest breakthroughs and largest outcomes will be built, at these sort of intersectional interfaces. And it really takes a unique founder, someone like Stef, to embody, you know, the knowledge and the fascination of both, in this case, bits and atoms, and really construct just a world-class team around that. I think he was really one of those conversations where you sort of fall in love in a first meeting. And I was completely hooked right from the get-go from him and the vision that he was able to portray and his experience and just how passionate he was about it. So really convinced that he would build something incredibly substantial and impactful. And then you meet Elisa and Eli and Harmon and Yele, and your conviction just skyrockets even further from there. And I was already starting at a pretty high altitude with Stef. So it's just such a strong team and a problem space that's incredibly large and exciting and right for the taking.
AI-powered protein design has seen striking development in recent years, with Cradle placing itself at the center of the conversation by providing bioengineers with tools to accelerate the design process. Steph and the entire Cradle team have both the vision and the technical and commercial abilities to drive meaningful advancements in this space, and we're incredibly excited to partner with them.
I mean, I'm as excited as you are. I left a very nice job at Google to go pursue this space. It's every day you meet founders that are building just fascinating things. So it's great. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
How did you assess the risk of it? You have a family. So it's like, should I leave a comfy job and start a startup that probably the chances of success are not that high?
Yeah, I mean, I've always tried to do more risky projects, even within my work at Google, typically early stage or sort of started something new. Of course, there is a higher probability of a startup failing, but you know, then you just go do another one is what they taught me in San Francisco if it doesn't work out. I do think it's definitely, you know, you get paid less and that kind of thing, but I'm not super money driven. And so yes, definitely some risk, but I think I'm probably still employable after this, if it fails, right?
And tell me more about your time at Google. What type of projects did you work with?
Yeah, sure. So I started my career at Google. So I've worked there for 7 years. Super grateful for having had the opportunity initially as a software engineer. And so I worked on a team called Social Impact First. They were doing things like elections information in Google Search, so like who can you vote on? Where are the voting locations, those types of things. And then another set of features that I hope you've never seen, it's for the crisis response area of search and maps. And so let's say there would be a massive snowstorm in Stockholm right now. You would get sort of alerts, a sense of like where you could go to be safe, you know, if there were flooding and super, you know, super cool to work on, but obviously not a feature you hope a lot of people see because like more natural disaster is not something you want. Yeah, so that's where I started. I realized a lot of people at Google are just incredibly good at writing code. And I'm a little sloppy, to be honest. And so I think after a year and a half, I decided to go onto product. So I ended up in a team that's called Location Insights. So they're doing a lot of work like based on where sort of all the phones go. Can you figure out where traffic is or how busy it is in an area, those types of things. Actually, I did a project with the Stockholm community at some point to figure out how sort of the closings of the ring road could be done better, which was super fun. Yeah, then moved on to, and that team was sort of between Android and Maps. And so I stayed in Android to work on a project that at the time was sort of as interesting as in it's Android for the car. It was super hot to like put Android in all the things like watches and televisions and that kind of thing. But cars were maybe not the most obvious wearable, but a super fun project, very different product, right? Sort of Android is made to have like apps and sort of be captive and that kind of thing. And you know, obviously in a car, you don't want to like watch YouTube videos because that's just super unsafe. And sort of how do you build like a product that still feels like Android and then integrates with the car and sort of that kind of thing. That was super exciting to build and really, really sort of a 0-to-1. Also hard to get done well. And so, yeah, did that for a while. I think when that was in the market, I was just less excited. I think a theme in my career has been sort of, I really like 0-to-1. And then as soon as sort of most of the things are there, then it's, you know, there's like other people that do that really well. So yeah, I went to Google X and spend a couple of years there. And you know, in the times I was working in Maps, we were using some early like machine learning type of approaches to do this, like, you know, how busy is the traffic, that kind of thing. And always kept sort of in touch with the people that were working. And so at the time it became pretty apparent that the sort of chips, like the hardware to train these very big models, was really one of the biggest limitations. Like the data was there, but the capacity to train and serve them wasn't there. So I ended up building a team together with my engineering co-founder in Google X that made a chip that does really well at machine learning workloads. And that team was ultimately not sort of spun out, but Google wanted to retain that technology. And so in my last job at Google, I was on the product leadership team of Google Research and Machine Intelligence, responsible for the fleet. So like all the hardware and the compilers and the sort of things that we were using to train and serve machine learning models. The second, you know, a bunch of software that sort of sits around that, like to like sort of MLOps, if you will. And then also started a couple of more sort of applied research projects. Yeah, and this is really where I sort of fell in love with biology. There were, you know, transformers and large language models were, you know, a thing 3 years ago, right? They were more in the research phase, and obviously they're like super popular. I think my mom now knows what a large language model is. But, you know, most people were applying them to like retrieval, like search, right? Or translation, or, you know, things like ranking ads. But there were like a few people that were applying them in very different domains, like biology. And sort of that's sort of what caught my curiosity in this domain. And I think I'm still in my honeymoon phase with biology for sure.
Google X is the part of Google that actually focuses on the moonshots.
Correct, yep.
How would you guys decide on which moonshot to focus on? Was it on how many people it can affect? What was the decision process there?
Yeah, so they actually had a little sort of Venn diagram with three bubbles. One was, is the problem large enough? So, and that would usually be defined, to your point, by can it impact more than a billion people? That was sort of the low bar. Then, is there a breakthrough technology? And that was sort of defined by sort of, you know, is there some technological insight that's non-trivial where you can get, you know, a lot better than what's currently out there? And then the third one was like, is the problem sort of big enough? Like, so they didn't want to do anything that's incremental, like with driving. You know, removing the driver from a car is a pretty significant step instead of sort of iterating your way towards something else. And so that sort of thinking of being very audacious. And then it was really sort of a portfolio approach. So you had, you know, what they called the early stage pipeline, that would be like 30 to maybe 100 projects. And, you know, the most crazy stuff people would try that, you know, the chances were very high that you wouldn't make it. And they were very time bound, like 9 months you have to show, otherwise, you know, kill it. And you were really sort of trained to kill things if they didn't work out and be very intellectually honest with yourself. And then there were sort of three stages, you know, sort of like a venture model where your team could grow a little bit until you were big enough to like spin out, which could either become your own Alphabet thing or go back to Google. Yeah, and for example, like some of the early work on ML, like Google Brain, actually started out in X, but then became, you know, a Google project. And obviously some things like Waymo and the self-driving car and some other projects that maybe got too big and should have been killed earlier, you know, or spun out.
You've been fairly early on with ML models. Like, what are the learnings there? How fast ML model can learn on different type of data, and then how fast you can actually be very practical with the models in real life?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. It honestly really depends on the use case. And so to give you a couple of examples, like in driving, you want to be very good. Like driving 10% correct is not very good. But even like driving 99.9999999% correct is still not very good, right? And so humans are actually not that bad at driving if they, you know, don't use any substances. For like something like translation, you know, 97% is already pretty good. You know, but maybe for something like search, you know, maybe 80% is already pretty good. Like some of the discussions, for example, about ChatGPT, I find interesting. Like OpenAI actually published a blog where they said it's like 30% truthful. That's not very truthful, right? Oh, and so yeah. Sort of, you know, how fresh is the information? How truthful is it? It really depends on the type of use case. You know, and this is something people often underestimate. And so typically I would say compare whatever the model can do, the task that the model can do, with how good the human is at it, and then see if you can get either at par or better, right? And so, yeah, typically if as an angel investor, I would invest in businesses where there's clearly a human element that is beaten. And so, for example, like turns out making robots grab things is really hard. Like our motor functions are super complicated things. And it looks very obvious to us that you can just, you know, grab an apple, but it turns out that's an unsolved problem for machine learning today. And then, you know, there's dozens of techniques and architectures and other things, but, you know, you just have to go look at papers if you're interested in that.
And what memories do you have from your time at Google or Alphabet that impacted the way you build products today?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it was quite a sort of experience. As a Dutch guy, you know, I wasn't very good at college. And so I think I got lucky getting into Google. And then suddenly you were in sort of Silicon Valley. People were optimistic, you know, like Elon was proposing rockets should do backflips in the atmosphere, that kind of thing, right? Something the Dutch would never, never, ever do, right? And suddenly you're in this company that isn't a consulting or, you know, the typical sort of jobs that you would do if you were in the Netherlands at the time. And there were a couple of things that really stood out. I think the first thing is really build incredibly high quality teams. And I think that sort of stayed with me throughout my entire career. Ultimately, make or break is mostly the humans you work with and execution, really. Like, I think we put too much emphasis on ideas and too little on do you have the humans to do it, right? I think that's an interesting one. The second one is, I would say, focus on the user. The speed by which people sort of get lost in the details and don't even ask users. Now, that's actually one of the reasons why I left Google. I felt like, you know, it was getting so big at a certain point where processes and whatever had taken over. And most of my job was like reviews and getting people to, you know, flip bits and give me approvals for things instead of, you know, and I would ask VPs, like, have you talked to a user in the last quarter? And it's like, no. Right? So I don't like that. And I think the second thing, and it sort of, or the third thing, and it sort of leads back to my intro, the sort of audaciousness, especially of folks in the United States, is really amazing. And, you know, where in Europe, I think we're sort of somewhat definite pessimists. If people would come to you, and really, like, you would have these large groups of executives that would come to Silicon Valley and they would ask me to do a talk, and I would ask them, like, in the audience, would you invest in a rocket that does backflips, right? And everyone's like, no, of course not, right? That sounds like a ridiculous idea. And I think in Silicon Valley especially, that culture is very much of like, huh, that's interesting. Why are you even proposing that? Like, there's a certain curiosity and audaciousness where people get to try hard things. And that was very counterintuitive to me, that is actually, you know, a very positive thing. Those were, I think, three things that really stood out for me. I think as it grew, right now, it is getting very big. And as a result, there's a lot more, Google has a very sort of communal culture where a lot of people are involved in decisions. And I think that is not scaling very well and is just making things a lot slower than it should be.
Yeah, just to add maybe one thing to the point that you said, like the difference between Europeans and Americans. I have a very good friend of mine, Jason from Miami. Shout out to Jason. But every time that I talk with him about an idea, he's like, oh yeah, that's interesting. And you could do this. And what about this? So he's kind of building on top of whatever I said, whereas like if I talk with a friend from Europe, they only think about why this is not going to
work. Yeah, I mean, even in your question, your first question was, wasn't it risky to do a startup, Steph, right?
Yeah. Well, I kind of ask it because I know that there are a lot of people that were in your shoes and they're thinking, should I leave a comfy job that are paying very well? Isn't this risky? So since you did it, I hope that you'll inspire them to actually to take the
chance. Maybe if that was the intent.
That was the intent.
The worst thing, if you were good at your previous job, they will take you. I think Google actually had a policy that if you came back within the year, you didn't have to interview again if you had like good reviews. And I think the second thing is typically finding a new job for highly educated people in the tech space is like 8 weeks. So just make sure you have some savings and you'll be fine, right?
Just do it. Have some savings and just do it.
And I mean, the learning experience is wild, right? It's really amazing. Yeah.
So tell us the founding story of Rado. The idea kind of came when you were at Google, but what were the next steps?
Yeah, sure. So maybe to set that context a bit more. So, you know, the Google Brain team is sort of the research team within Google that sort of applies ML to all kinds of problems. And I got in touch with one of my co-founders, Eli, who was working on a team that were applying that to DNA. And I was like, why would you want to do that? Right. Sort of, you know, that doesn't seem like a Google product. And he got me super excited because, you know, you can think of DNA as sort of this alien programming language that we found. But we have no way of writing to it. Like, we don't have compilers or a formal language we can use to sort of, as humans, make it do what we want, right? But it's highly complex. Like, you know, all of the chemistry that you can do in your body is just phenomenal, right? And that's just literally strings of sugars, right, that sort of make that happen. And he was like, you know, this is, like, really much better than some of the tools that these people are using today. And just to give you a sense, like, if you're a really good team in biology and you're making changes to DNA to make it do what you want, as if it's code, like, you're very good if you get it right 1% of the time, then you're very good, right? And then, oh yeah, it takes like 4 weeks to test whether your thing actually works. So equivalent of sort of computer programming would be, here's a blob of binary, you don't get a compiler, go flip some bits, you hit run, and then like 4 weeks from now, we're going to tell you whether you did something correctly or not, right? And then, you know, the way that they solve that is by like trying 100 programs, right? Anyway, so that's sort of the TLDR of what these people are doing. And, you know, very dedicated, like, lots of awesome science, but like that's a really hard problem. So I got like super fascinated by that. You know, started reading books, like maybe pro tip for some of the people in your audience. The best question I think you can ask people that you interview about a new space is like, which books in undergrad actually mattered? It's usually two or three. And just go read those and you have a pretty good introduction into a new field. I mean, you know, it takes a couple of afternoons, but it's fine, right? Anyway, so I think I've interviewed over 100 biologists at the time and just ask them about their life, like how you would do any type of product discovery.
Would you just reach out on LinkedIn? You're like, hey, I see that you're a biologist. I'm really interested in this problem. I would like to solve it. Do you have 30 minutes to talk to me?
It was kind of funny. Like, actually, my co-founder, Elise, this is how we met. One of the Dutch newspapers covered her and And apparently she was in Joshua Tree in California, sort of climbing a mountain. And she got a text from a friend that said, like, some dude from Google wants to talk to you about, like, using AI to revolutionize biology. And her first response was like, arrogant bastards, right? Sort of like... Anyway, it all worked out in the end. But anyway, and so, you know, basically learn three things, right? One, it is a really hard problem to make biology do what you want. I think second, the software that is built for biotech people is not great. And so the tools, and I've been a tool builder throughout my career, the tools are just not very good. And that's really inhibiting, right? It's sort of like how, you know, making an app in the 90s, like, good luck, you had to call IBM, get a mainframe, right? There was like lots of inhibition to get to something that actually was sort of easy, right? And a small team could do. And then I think the third thing is I just realized the sort of magnitude of the opportunity, right? And if you look at sort of the broader picture, you know, most of the inputs we use for our society today are like, you know, animals, oil, and then, you know, ores and things from the ground, like rare metals, that kind of thing. But like these first two categories, like anything that's biological, you could, like, nature has found the most energy efficient way of doing that, right? And so if you can reprogram that a little bit to make it do what we want, right, that's like, and McKinsey actually calculated like 60% of our current economic inputs you could make with biology instead of petrochemicals or animals or, you know, and just the statistics just wild, right? And so, you know, anyway, got excited, as you can hear, dug in a little bit more. And I think, I don't know, like a little over a year and a half ago, we started Cradle to help basically allow for science teams to make programming biology a little bit easier for them. Yeah.
That's amazing. I watched the talk that you and Elisa made at Slush, and I really liked the comparison that the proteins are the assembly lines and the cells are the factories. So it is a little bit mind-blowing that you can actually program cells to make milk, to make plastic, to make
medicines,
petrol-free chemicals. What are the breakthroughs that happened in the past that actually makes this possible today?
Yeah, sure. Before I go there, let me give a little bit of a bio 101 for your audience, because it's typically useful for them. So to your point, we have cells. Inside of the cells, there's a little hard disk with your DNA. And then that hard disk can sort of execute programs. We call it RNA, right? And then there's a little buddy called a ribosome, and it can make little proteins. And proteins are machines. So they can be elements, like they can be the wall of a cell, but they can also catalyze a certain chemical reaction. Now, multiple proteins in a row, right, become a little factory, and they can turn some original thing, like sugar, into something else. Like, and, you know, a lot of people's favorite ones are like yeasts. You know, sugar comes in, alcohol comes out. Like, that's actually a very different molecule, right? But there's a bunch of proteins in a row there that do that work. And obviously, a lot of biologists will tweet me that that's all wrong, but I'm trying to make it simple. And so by altering the DNA of the proteins that get made in the cell, you can sort of change, if you will, the factory lines to make them do other things. So that's one. Second is proteins themselves can be a product, right? And so for those that took a vaccine that was RNA-based, basically what that did is you got injected an instruction. That instruction was delivered into your cell. The little buddy, the ribosome, folded it into the spike. So the spike was like the little hat of the COVID. And then the cell would be like, why is this hat here? It will throw the head into your bloodstream. Your immune system is like, we don't like hats. It beats up the hat, right? And then next time a dude with a hat shows up, that's the TLDR of how they worked, right? And so Amazing. You can use them as medicine as well. Some things like products are proteins, like insulin is a protein. You know, whey, like the one of the major substances in milk, is a protein. And so proteins themselves can be products as well. Okay, so then your question, what are the breakthroughs in the past that made this possible? I'll try to use some computer science analogies because they work for me, because I'm not a biologist, but the process of trying something out in biology basically boils down to you design a sequence, so you change the DNA in some way, you put it in an organism, typically a microbe like a yeast or an E. coli or something like that. That microbe will do what I just said. It will express, like it will make the protein. And then the final step is you test whether it does something. And, you know, what are things that biologists typically look for? It might be like, does it make more of the thing? If I heat it up, does it fall apart, right? Like they call that stability. did it grab onto the right molecule, not to the other ones, right? They call it promiscuity. And so those are like typical things that people are trying to engineer. So in that process, there's a couple of things that used to be incredibly expensive but are starting to get a lot cheaper. First of all, making DNA. You can order DNA from companies like Twist and IDT, and they'll send you a little vial. Well, usually a plate full of them, you know, and you can suck them out with a little pipette and then inject them into cells, and then they will start making whatever you program. That has become dramatically cheaper. That's sort of a Moore's Law type of thing, and it's on a downward curve. And so writing, if you will, has become a lot cheaper. The second thing is a lot of the techniques to sort of do, have a little cell, express something in it, those techniques are cheaper now. Like there's super cool hardware like the Opentrons, which will move all these liquids around and sort of do all kinds of cool bio tricks. You know, that's effectively a 3D printer. Used to cost hundreds of thousands of dollars, now a lot cheaper. And then the final thing is a lot of the testing and sequencing has become a lot cheaper. So figuring out, did I actually make the right thing? And then experimenting and figuring out, like, did it fall apart? Does it make the right molecule? Those types of techniques have also become a lot cheaper. And so that's really driving this. And I think we're still very much at the start of this. So yeah, so that's the driver. What hasn't really changed that much, so biology, because it's become cheaper, we've sort of scaled up experimentation, like we are doing more experiments per unit of time. We haven't really gotten that much better at making the individual experiments much more successful. Like that number of like 1% of sequences actually work, that is still pretty low. And so we think as CRADL that that's where the most headroom is. If you can actually get more sequences to work in your lab or to do what you want, you know, then the cost of running a startup just go down dramatically. And I think my favorite quote from one of these 100 like people I interviewed, one was a founder, and he was like, my team has like a 1% success rate in the lab. I just don't know, you know, which 1%. I do know it's 80% of my runway up until Series B, right? And so try to imagine even multiplying that number to 2, right, would be a dramatic reduction in capital required to get somewhere. And so for us, like, success would be everybody starts pitching VCs bugs, right? There's a cool company called Nopalm. They're making palm oil with a bug instead of a palm tree. You know, Elisa worked at Perfect Day. They're making cow milk without a cow, right? By using a fungus to secrete that. You know, there's like companies like Solugen. They're making chemicals, like literally are competing with companies like BASF. They have a factory, massive scale factory. Like sugar and water and CO2 goes in, fancy chemicals come out, and they can make it at like 40% of the cost price of the chemical, like petrochemical alternative. That's wild.
That's amazing. Yeah. So this is actually available right now.
Yes.
This is actually producing right now.
So this field is called synthetic biology, and it's really booming. Yeah.
I also know that, and also you mentioned like in the beginning of this interview, that also you're an investor, so you're part of Operator Exchange. You recently raised your seed round of around $6 million. How did the perspective of being an investor help you during the fundraise?
I think mostly having seen lots of decks helps. Because you kind of become your own user. As in, okay, if I wanted to invest in me, what would I like to see, right? So that helps.
Yeah, so can you give some examples? So how did you build your deck by seeing a lot of decks?
Yeah, so simplify. Don't assume VCs actually know something, right? Yeah. Especially in deep tech, I think a lot of founders fall in love with their technology and they think it's obvious to everybody, but you really need to bring it back to sort of fundamentals. So I think that's one. You know, basic things like explain why your team is capable of executing this, you know, explain what the actual problem is, right? Just don't omit that. So don't be a technology in search of a problem. Those types of things, yeah, I think are typically something that you find as you just see a lot of them. I would recommend any founder that starts, like, become an angel investor on AngelList just for a month. You don't even have to put actual money into things, right? But just look at all the decks in your space. That's just going to be fantastic education to make a better deck.
I agree. And let's change gears a little bit and let's get personal. For someone listening and thinking, should I leave my comfy job? What would you advise?
Yes. I mean, obviously anything you do in life has a risk, but typically in a startup, you'll figure out within 2 years whether it's going to work or not. And so the downside risk is you're going to learn a lot, right? I think once somebody once joked at me, your first startup is tuition, right? So you're just going to learn an incredible amount of things because you have to do everything, right? And I think my learning compared to the last couple of years at Google and the last 12 months, it's like an order of magnitude difference between the two. And so that you'll get. A lot of people will, even if it doesn't work, will applaud you for having tried it. A lot of future employers will see, oh, wait, this is actually someone that dares to try something. I still haven't met anyone that would say, oh, that's a really bad thing to have on your resume. The money is not going to matter that much, right? You know, it's a couple of years, whatever. And then most companies, if you were good before, will still want to have you a couple of years later. So there really is very little risk. Sure, it can fail. But, you know, that's a little bit more of the sort of European-American vibe. You don't go into it assuming it's going to fail. But, yes, there is a probability that happens, and you just try again, right? As long as you were honest with your investors, as long as you try it your best, right, then I don't think anyone's ever going to... The biggest surprise I get from most of my own angel investor founders that failed is sort of how chill everybody is that that happens. And they're like, yeah, that happens. It's okay, right? And then they're like, oh, no, it's totally failed. I'm like, no, it's fine, right? Yep. That's why we have portfolios, right?
Exactly. To mitigate the risk.
Yep.
Also, I think, like you said, one thing that I think is very crucial, because you're just intrinsically motivated about a problem. You're just so curious.
This is what I want to solve. Yes, absolutely.
Exactly. So you just have to have that intrinsical motivation, because things will get tough. So if you don't have that intrinsical motivation to solve this problem, probably you will give
up. Oh, yeah. And to your point, the anti-thesis for doing a startup is because I want to make money, right? You should go into investment banking or something like that if you want that. Like, don't do a startup for that reason. There's, to your point, a high probability of it becoming worth zero. If it's not that, you know, matter that much, right? So it's, I'll be the motivation. It should really be the work. And I have that. Like, I every day I'm like, oh my freaking God, biology is so fucking awesome, right? And my users, I was talking 2 weeks ago, awesome company, Maverick Bioworks, an early sign-up form, right? And people can sort of type in their name and what industry they work on. And we have a bunch of like pre-selectors, like pharma, materials, blah, blah. And suddenly this person had clicked like other and then colon mining. I'm like, mining, right? So it turns out what these guys do, move, let's say, lithium or some other ore that you want from the rest of the thing you dug up, is typically by heating it up to like 1500 Celsius and then throwing some really nasty chemicals in it. And guys are basically making an enzyme, like a little protein, that can do that at like ambient temperature in a vat of water, right? And you're like, that's awesome, right? That's so amazing.
That's amazing.
Sorry,
yeah.
I'm yeah. Anyway, yes, you have to be excited about what you do.
Exactly. If you're just like 50% excited, as Steph is just talking about this, I think you're on the right path.
Yes. But similarly, to your point, that is going to drag you through it, right? Through the hardships. It's hard to do still, but it's really, yeah, it's the thing that gets me out of bed every morning.
What is your advice for someone raising a seed round right now?
Yeah, I mean, obviously the market has changed from a couple of years ago. I think for the better, to be honest, like valuations were just bizarre and, you know, yeah. So we're back to 2020 now. That's good. I think one of the things I learned from our process is that actually starting with the right team is probably the most important thing that people can do. I see a lot of people prematurely start raising money without having figured out their plan and figured out their team. I think in our case, we did figure out the team. The plan was still a bit shaky, I must confess. But, you know, that is definitely something I found. Second, you know, be long-term greedy. A lot of these VCs are panicking a bit right now because, you know, all their crypto funds are down. And, you know, and so it's fine to take a little bit of dilution early on. The actual valuation doesn't really matter that much, right? It's a bridge loan into the future. Don't optimize for valuation. Just optimize for working with the right partner. We really tried to spend a lot of time, like, do we like these humans? Because, like marriage... you're going to be hanging out with them for quite a while. And so we have some really awesome investors that we really love. That's what I would recommend. Other than that, you know, it's a great time to build, right? A lot of good companies get built in these moments of scarcity where suddenly, you know, gravity returns to markets and it's not just about growth and that kind of thing, but actual unit economics matter. I actually much more prefer that world where, you know, a product is only done when it can sustain itself, right? And it's not if it's not. And so a lot of financial engineering is cool and it can drive valuations up. But I don't actually think it's in the long-term interest of products either.
What did you like about Index? Why did you choose them?
Yeah, so we really wanted a mix, actually, of both a generalist fund that has really seen a lot of B2B SaaS, and, you know, Index's operating platform is also really amazing, combined with a smaller firm that had a little bit more domain knowledge in biology. In Europe, unfortunately, there are not that many. That was actually the third requirement. We had a bunch of investors also in the US that were interested, but, you know, the sort of, it's kind of nice if you can call someone in your same time zone. Yeah, and then so Layla at Kindred, you know, really amazing. She's been an operator at a biotech before, and that really helps. So, you know, in the board meeting, when we have to use biology words, it's like, that's awesome. And Chris was at Amazon. He built sort of the first commercial motions here in Europe for AWS. We're not AWS, but there are definitely a bunch of similarities between what's happening in bio and sort of that, you know, suddenly three people from undergrad can build a $1 billion company. Like, I want that in biology. Like, three people should be able to make a medicine that's billions of dollars, right? That would be success. I think on the Index side, we have Carlos and Sophia. I think both are amazing investors, a lot of experience in B2B SaaS. Yeah, and so I think we're just incredibly lucky with the people that we ended up with. So yeah, I'm very, very happy with where we are right now.
What does success mean to you, Steph?
Professionally, I would say I've always been somebody that builds for others to build on top of. And so I don't want to be that, per se, that person in the spotlight, but I can be very excited about, for example, in ML research, all of those papers and applications that were made possible by an infrastructure that didn't exist before, right? And they don't mention any of our team on that paper. No. But I can sort of snicker and be like, haha, right? Or similarly, you know, I still have it when I like rent a car, when I land somewhere, I drive on the freeway at night and I see sort of all the little Android autos with like certain music apps and certain, I'm like, that's cool. Like, I built that distribution channel or helped build that distribution channel. And so I do think that ultimately the things that really change the world are things that change how people build, right? And like TensorFlow is an interesting example. I remember discussions, you know, I had to do the math like on should we invest in these types of software tools, right? And at the time we guesstimated maybe 80,000 people could write an ML model. And then most of the people I would talk to in ML were like, I know I don't write my own back prop, right? I don't need a fancy framework. And so, you know, there was a little bit of a gamble of like, is this actually going to take off? Because there were like, you know, millions of app developers at the time, right? So it felt very niche-y. And so, yeah, and anyway, sort of making the bridge to today, I think professional success for me in this context would be hundreds of thousands of people started making shit with biology. That's it. I think personally, it's mostly be a kind person, right? I want people to remember me. The speed by which humans turn into assholes as they progress through their career is still something I find phenomenal.
I agree. I've heard this question. If you would have to choose for your children to be kind or intelligent, what would you choose?
Kind, for sure.
Kind.
They'll get more opportunities that way.
Tell me about a book that had an outsized impact on your life, or about a research paper in your case.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I do read a lot of things that are not fiction or sort of, you know, theories about life or that kind of thing. I mean, for me, the sort of thing that got Cradle started was the book called Molecular Biology of the Cell. It was, you know, one of those books that got recommended by a lot of people that said, oh yeah, in my undergrad biology, that was actually a pretty decent book to read. Not all the chapters, though. I would agree with them on that. But it's, I mean, the kinds of things that biology can do is kind of incredible. And sort of the little amount of energy that we need to do such incredible complexity is pretty bizarre. Like that little plant behind you, you know, it became that big. And just for the listeners, it's about the size of his window. It doesn't get a lot of sun. We talked about it just before the recording started. But it literally became that big by just ambient carbon and a little bit of water and minerals, right? And a little chain of sugars that gave it some instructions.
And some classical music.
Probably, it's probably why the leaves are a bit bigger. Yeah. No, and that's just phenomenal. And there's these, you know, every time you read about like another mechanism and sort of how well it works, you know, there's these little things they call chaperones that can like move things out of the cell. They actually like walk. You should Google, like, for everybody here, maybe you can put it in show notes, like how the ATP synthesis process works, which is like there's a little engine that just revs and just turns sugars into like the energy building blocks of the cell. And it's mind blowing, right? It's so cool. Yeah. Anyway, so that's what excites me right now. No fiction or business advice, unfortunately.
It kind of feels that we are at a brink of a revolution. Maybe at the same way that we had the steam engine, we now have the opportunity to understand at such a granular level how a plant, how an animal, how anything grows, and be able actually to engineer that.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely bought into that. And so I think of the revolutions that could be, I think we're living the ML one right now. And that's basically, mm-hmm. you know, human intelligence being augmented by machines. But the things that we can program to date are still relatively limited, right? And even if you look at just market sizes, like, you know, pharma compared to like online advertising, it's like, I mean, you know, they eat Google's lunch every week, right? That's crazy. And so the thing that really sort of brought me to that moment was try to imagine if you can program like 60% of our current physical things around us, but that's not everything. Mm. That's just the things we have today, right? There's like companies that are working on data storage using DNA. You know, there's like biosensors. So people that are basically attaching little lights to proteins and they can like measure things. And, you know, I was at the SynBio Beta conference last year. There's a guy, he made a plant and he put a protein that gives light. You might find those in some of these like deep sea fish, mm-hmm. right? He put it in a plant because he thought, yeah, it's kind of cool to have a plant that lights up at night, right? And I'm like, probably not the first thing I would go solve, right? Right, but holy shit, like he had a little booth that you could sort of go look at it. It's like, oh cool, yeah, it's like shining in the booth, right? Like a little fish, right?
That's crazy. I saw actually like one person did that with a dog, and I thought, oh, poor dog.
Yeah,
it was like a fluorescent dog, and I'm like, how would the dog sleep?
I think honestly, the philosophers from, I mean, we're talking about like, is it cool for the machines to take over our jobs, right? We're going to get into that whole world of what's cool to do with bio and not, and it's going to be a lot more real in the next 10 years for sure. Yeah. Yep.
The ethical question.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, even like for us, we had to write in our terms of service, like what are the things you can and cannot do, right? And then even having definitions of like, don't do things that are toxic, right? Don't do things that could be a carcinogenic, so like cause cancer, right? Don't do things that screw up cloning. Sort of, you know, there's like lots of things you don't want to screw up in bio. And, you know, it's super important for us. And that's even that, like I totally fund a startup that would do biosafety as a service because it's, you know, it's gonna get very interesting. Yeah.
Listen up, guys. Biosafety as a service. That's an opportunity.
Yep.
There you go. And one last question. If Steph from 10 years ago would listen to this episode, what would you tell him?
So, I mean, I was brought up in a society, the Dutch society, that's pretty risk avoidant. Like there's actually a saying in Dutch culture that's don't stick your head above the field, the hay field, because it will be cut off, right? And I think especially in Europe, we're way too risk averse. And I was very risk averse initially as well. It's actually my wife who said, you should not work for like McKinsey. You should just go do something fun and, you know, I'll move and whatever, right? And so one person in the Bay Area described it really nicely. I think Europeans are definite pessimists. Like, Europe is awesome, people, right? There's so much safety. I mean, we were talking about, oh, should I do a startup? Because, you know what happens in the U.S.? If your startup fails, you get no money, right? Absolutely nothing. There's no social whatever, nothing, right? Here in Switzerland, literally when I stopped Google, the Gemeinde called, it's like, oh, we noticed you don't have a job anymore. Do you need money, right? Like, no, I'm fine. I'm in between things, right? So everything actually in Europe is pretty cool. The only thing is nobody's trying something, right? Mm. And I think it's actually an opportunity that will hopefully come up as sort of more examples of cool startups that are being built here. Because, you know, we write all the papers. We have all the awesome universities, right? There's nothing wrong in that sense with Europe. But it's just a lot of people that are like, I can have this very well set out career path in this bank. And you're like, oh my God, right? So I think, you know, be a definite optimist, like try things. I think of all the strategies that people have tried to teach me, that one was the one I was definitely not expecting and the one that has sort of yielded the best results for me. And it makes sense, right? It's sort of if you work on something that's hard, it attracts much better people, right? Because, you know, good people have done cool things before and they want to do something that's more ambitious. It has a much higher impact on the world, so you can be prouder of yourself. And then the other cool thing, typically there's less competition, right? You can do the other, another like fintech SaaS for SaaS thing. It's like, I think we have enough crazy APIs for money people, right?
I agree. Love it.
Anyway, so everybody should go do an undergrad in biology and go build some bugs. Right?
Amazing. Thanks so much, Steph. I had so much fun actually during this episode.
This was super fun.
Thanks so much for taking the time, and have fun on building Cradle and changing the world.
Thank you so much, and thanks for having me.